Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I keep on forgetting that, folks, we've got a candidate that is committed to demanding full compliance of the Constitution. This candidate is actually running for state auditor in Missouri. This candidate, we're going to actually start having conversations with him. Probably next week we'll have the first one air about the problem he's facing in the state of Missouri, a very red conservative state. Again, folks, when I say conservative, that has nothing to do with constitutional. You need to start severing the usage of conservative when it comes to politics, because conservative and constitutional do not meet. When people talk about a conservative position on education, what they're literally telling you is we want to have a good moral education system. That's conservative. A constitutional position on education is we don't want government assuming that they can actually give us an education system because it's not in the Constitution. There's a huge difference. So, we're going to be talking with Gerald, next week, and we'll be interviewing him once a week for at least a little while to give you the magnitude of the problem that he's dealing with in the state of Missouri regarding the Republican Party. And I mean, he could easily go onto a third-party ticket and, you know, have a campaign that goes all the way to the election, but there's no way a third party is going to make it into a state run, especially in a corrupt state like that. And when I mean corrupt, they do everything to make sure you're primaried out. The Democrats and the Republicans work together. If they perceive anybody that's going to be a true threat to that party system, that uniparty system that they have created, because I'm telling you, folks, they are working together. And there's been evidence of this. And actually, I think we had Paul Venable talk about that. But nevertheless, we need to continue learn, pray, and act. And the whole point, and this is why we're getting behind candidates that are standing up, signing pledges, and saying, hold me accountable. I will be accountable to my oath of office to the Constitution. And we want to start holding everybody accountable. The day we start holding everybody accountable to their oath is the day government begins to work for us again. It's that simple. Literally is. And so yesterday we were, and I told you that, you know, we were going to do something different because we weren't going to have Tammy here, but, you know, the heavens have parted and we have a miracle and Tammy is with us today. Thank you so much for joining us again, Tammy.
Hallelujah.
You're welcome.
So Sean is with us. So we have the full complement of, you know, the team, at least the educational team, because that's what we're here to educate you. We're here to help you hear these words, these documents, and so forth by reading them so that you don't have to take our word for it. I have learned my lesson. I think I've said this before, that when you go through classes and you're reading, a textbook in upper-level college, those textbooks are nothing but editorials that the professors are basically, you know, regurgitating the narrative that they want you to, you know, embrace and move forward. They're not teaching you, especially when it comes to the law, when it comes to the Constitution, when it comes to civics and our framework of civics and government. They don't want you to know the truth. The court doesn't want you to know the truth because they have obscene controls over you right now if you don't know the truth. So that's why we're in the pickle we're in, and that's why we're doing what we're doing. So we were covering this document called Usufruct, Thomas Jefferson to James Madison. And this, again, is 16 September 1789. Now, Thomas Jefferson has been in the Americas. I'm trying to remember. I think he's reported to the State Department because they formed the government, and Thomas Jefferson had not arrived until probably summertime. So he's only really been there just a few months. And his exposure to the Constitution was, you know, and the ratification process was overseas. The Constitution had been ratified, and the government was forming, and he was being selected as the Secretary of State while he was still on a boat. He hadn't even officially heard that he was selected and hadn't even accepted the position from George Washington until he got back. So at least, you know, as I'm recalling in, you know, all this dusty gray matter up in between my ears here. And so the reason this is important is because Thomas Jefferson had to start learning some of the nuances and details of this new Constitution. And that's because the paradigm prior to this was different. And we're going to get into that because this next paragraph kind of exposes Thomas Jefferson by saying something. And so, and I kind of mentioned this before, that Thomas Jefferson had just gotten back. So this concept of the land belonging to the living was something that obviously was a philosophical concept that was probably percolating in Europe because Europe was running out of land. Anybody know, I mean, Sean or Tammy, the World War I was started because of some manipulation and so forth. But for the most part, the real drive behind World War I, do you know what it was?
Land.
Land. Germany didn't have enough land to truly feed itself. And they were just coming out of this huge tragedy that the German people inflicted upon themselves by actually allowing Otto von Bismarck to basically throw them under an economic bus. Do you know what that economic bus was? Either of you? If you don't, it's okay. It was called socialism. Otto von Bismarck created socialism in the mid to late 1800s, and he actually created, believe it or not, he created the Social Security Administration. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? And so people in Germany loved this beautiful system because everybody kind of got it all kicked off, and everything was going pretty good. And Ludwig von Mises and others, I think Friedrich Hayek and others, were really saying, hey, you don't know what you're doing here. This is not going to work. And as everybody was ignoring them, Ludwig von Mises packed up and he left. And I think later on, Friedrich Hayek and others actually started heading to America as well. I think Friedrich Hayek was in the UK or in Britain at the time he wrote The Road to Serfdom, because The Road to Serfdom was really a warning. Most people think it was a warning to the United States, but it was a warning because Britain was beginning to go down this exact same path of implementing socialism. And so, these men who understood economics, that when you're giving government the full reign and control over productivity, basically, it's communism with a smiley face.
Right.
And so Otto von Bismarck literally started creating this system where it is nothing but wreaked havoc throughout all of Europe that has implemented these types of principles, where at a certain age you can retire and you'll live off of the work of everybody else. The presumption is that most people won't want to retire early. But the reality is everybody wants to retire early and live off the fat of others. At least the paradigm that it has been in Europe, because it has devastated both Germany in the 1800s. And look at what it's done to Greece, Spain, Italy, and so forth, as they've implemented and had to deal with these ruinous types of, I'll just call them government policies and economic policies. So So anyway, Otto von Bismarck and Germany basically had to step aside, get rid of him, and now they were struggling because there was hardly anybody working, and they didn't have, you know, a really good economic machine. They needed land, and they needed more food. And so that started really pushing boundaries. And bottom line is they ended up, and there was manipulation that caused it all, but it started the First World War, and it actually led into the Second World War. And what I mean by that is that because Germany was so devastated after the World War One, after losing World War One, their economy just went terrible. They became so susceptible that Hitler rose to power very quickly. And Hitler convinced them all to again implement another statist government. And in so doing, he actually started creating this machine, this very productive machine. And I don't know if you ever, there was a movie that Mel Brooks did that basically, you know, had a comical view that Hitler just wanted peace. He wanted a piece of Austria. He wanted a piece of Italy. And so, and Mel Brooks, and Mel Brooks was, you know, doing this, you know, kind of musically. But that's what was happening because they needed the land, and they saw the land was, you know, not, you know, owned or being housed. So they said, you know, that's agricultural land. We need agricultural land. We're going to take that. And they were getting, oh, I shouldn't say they were really getting away with it. People were pushing back, but nobody had the war machine that Hitler had built already. Nobody saw what Hitler had done in creating his brown shirts and so forth, in preparing to go external and to start seizing land and so forth. That's what everybody ignored. Anyway, so into this now, back to this. What we're looking at is Thomas Jefferson had come back where this idea of how are we going to, as independent sovereign states without a union in Europe, going to compete? How are we going to survive? And so let's get back to what Thomas Jefferson is now saying in this phase of the letter to James Madison. And whose turn is it? Tammy, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Tammy. Go ahead.
On similar ground, it may be proved that no society can make a perpetual constitution or even a perpetual law. The earth belongs always to the living generation. They may manage it then, and what proceeds from it, as they please during their usufruct. They are masters, too, of their own persons, and consequently may govern them as they please. But persons and property make the sum of the objects of government. The Constitution and the laws of their predecessors extinguished then in their natural course with those who gave them being. This could preserve that being till it ceased to be itself and no longer. Every Constitution then and every law naturally expires at the end of 19 years. If it be enforced longer, it is an act of force and not of right. It may be said that the succeeding generation, exercising in fact the power of repeal, leaves them as free as if the Constitution or law has been expressly limited to 19 years only. In the first place, this objection admits the right in proposing an equivalent, but the power of repeal is not an equivalent. It might be, indeed, if every form of government were so perfectly contrived that the will of the majority could always be obtained fairly and without impediment. But this is true of no form. The people cannot assemble themselves. Their representation is unequal and vicious. Various checks are opposed to every legislative proposition. Factions get possession of the public councils. Bribery corrupts them. Personal interests lead them astray from the general interests of their constituents, and other impediments arise so as to prove to every practical man that a law of limited duration is much more manageable than one which needs a repeal.
Okay, so let's first start off with what he says at the very beginning, because he didn't necessarily understand this new form of government. When he left, and we mentioned yesterday that he was the first author that wrote the first real true literary piece of work called The State of Virginia, or The State of the State of Virginia, something like that. That was literally just kind of a report to, you know, to the people of Virginia and the people of the Union. You know, what the heck's going on in Virginia? You know, their government and so forth. This was 1783. And so as Jefferson was dealing with states at that point in time, the states were literally being formed by at least the state of Virginia, and in his paradigm, the people were creating the state. They didn't go through the counties, because they didn't have county governments, or I should say, they kind of had them, but they marginalized them, because why have all these layers of government? So when you create a government by the people, the paradigm, which has been in this paradigm's embraced by the sovereign citizens, that every person that is born has to basically, because it's a government of the people, they all have to obtain buy-in of this government to continue. The language of the Articles of Confederation was a confederation that was perpetual, but it was limited. In other words, as we went through at the very beginning of this year, Tammy and I went through, you know, the Articles of Confederation, Articles of Association, and we laid out how impotent this confederation was. How Continental Congress, I mean, didn't even have the ability to really buy to obtain money, requisitions, and get funding from the states who were supposed to be supporting them to buy pencils and paper. So there were real problems in how they created the government, because the state governments were not going to give a general government any power at all. Jefferson was well aware of these looming problems, and that the states were the center of the future of government, that these things technically were created by the will of the people. So you can actually, and as a matter of fact, Federalist Paper 49, you know, I'm not a fan of, citing Federalist Papers, but James Madison actually cited a small portion out of Jefferson's State of the State of Virginia, and he talked about, you know, how to use leverage with the legislature or the executive in trying to create a convention, you know, in holding accountable another branch of government. And actually, if you read the title of Federalist Paper 49, it's the methodology of holding one, branch of government accountable via a convention. And so the convention of state folks like using that as saying, aha, see, the convention is the method. Yeah, I guess so, if you had that kind of constitution. But we don't have that kind of constitution. We don't have a constitution that was written for and by the people. We have people telling us that we do, but we actually had a constitution that was written by delegates of the state. And when the constitution came back, it was ratified by the state, not by the people. In other words, there was never one state that actually had a popular vote and left it to the people to choose whether they were going to ratify the Constitution or not. As a matter of fact, the methodology of ratification, which is right in the Constitution itself, was to be done in convention. In other words, by representatives of the people throughout the state to determine, instead of having the state legislature do it, the people would form or select their delegates that would go into convention to determine whether they would ratify it for the people or not. So in other words, the people didn't do it. The people chose their representatives. And guess what? The representatives were the who's who of politics at the time. There wasn't, Tom, Dick, and Harry going. It was, Patrick Henry, James Madison. I mean, the names that we were seeing in government anyway. So, it's nice, and it's a nice feel-good story to think that, you know, yeah, our government was made for them by the people, but actually, I believe our creator, the divine hand of providence, saw a far more important way of creating a perpetual government. Because literally, as attitudes change, the whims of the people, you're really forming more of a democracy, because the whims of the people can literally change things quickly. But he gave us a constitution that made it very difficult to do that. And he created these checks and balances within the system that everybody started realizing, wow, this is a pretty resilient government. It is a perpetual government. Why is it perpetual? Because when people, as Jefferson points out, when people die, new people come along and they want something different. But it wasn't the people that created it. Who created it? Again, it was the states. Do states die? No. Do counties die? No. So in other words, when we look at the foundation of the next government created, see, we the people do create our counties. And those counties can literally, you know, oscillate, vacillate, whatever you want to call it. They can go back and forth between, you know, strategic and tactical, you know, broad looking or, you know, very focused. But the point is that as long as that government, that county, and its structure is maintained, it is a perpetual entity. And that's why today our counties still exist today, because we've continued to support them. The biggest problem, the biggest miracle, is that they still actually exist. The mistake that the state made, and the states throughout the union, the mistake that they made, is they didn't dissolve these things and actually create their own governments. Had they done that, then we, in letting them do that, would have actually taken away our government and our ability to control the state again. But because every state in the union, this is very important, folks, because every state in the union was created by their counties, and because those county governments still do exist, even though we, the people, never established those county governments, we can. We can go and create a county constitution and claim that government is ours and delegate to them specifically those things we want them to govern us by. Therefore, taking away these unconstitutional strings that the creature has created to their masters. In other words, because the state government amassed and the counties gave them some powers that they shouldn't have had, they actually said, you know what, you're going to work for us. You're going to do these things for us. Well, technically, they didn't have that authority to do it. They started assuming those things. This is why every county has become an administrative body to the states and bureaucracies. So I'm just telling you, folks, that Jefferson and even the framers did not realize the providence, the wisdom that the divine hand of providence integrated into our constitutions. And so had, I think, people really knew the, you know, what we could do now, I think they would have gotten rid of the counties. Or maybe they didn't do that because they didn't want to tip their hand. Because 9 times out of 10, when the bad guys start burning books, everybody starts grabbing those books that they're burning and saying, there's something in here, folks. There's something in here. We gotta save these things. Because they're tipping their hand. So anyway, I wanted to dive into what Jefferson was talking about was really based on his lack of really understanding this new concept of this hybrid constitution republic. Because the foundation of our republic are our county constitutions of county government, which forms these state general governments to serve the sovereignty of the people and their counties, which then formed the federal government. Had we done it from ground up and actually really understood the best way to do this, had we been fed, you know, from manna and you know, living in the desert, have we started off by being fed manna and started from the ground up, this is what we would have really done, because the Constitution has basically led us to this path. Because this is why, well, I'm going to run out of time, and so I'll just finish this thought when we come back, and we'll get back into what Thomas Jefferson is talking about. So, folks, Bear with me. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so as I was saying, when the Constitution was created, the divine hand of providence realized that we were already well down the stream of having pretty mature governments. But by giving us a Constitution that was exemplar in creating checks and balances, it became evident and actually paramount that we really reconsidered our framework at the state level and even below in creating governments with checks and balances, with these divisions and separations of power. In other words, this constitutional design was such a gold standard that it literally helped us wake up to not only did we have an awesome, limited and defined federal government, we needed to start doing that to the states. So when the states started coming into the union, we were doing that. And now we've got a point where infrastructure and the government, you know, we've created some advancements of life and society that we're actually, government should be providing some services. And we can talk all about that because government has been doing that and has done that. But right, wrong, or indifferent, that what is basically has happened is that the counties have become far more integral in our day-to-day lives, and that we made the mistake of not actually doing it right. But the beautiful thing is we still have counties and we can get it right. That's the beautiful thing. Had they actually completely perverted things and dissolved the counties and literally made amendments to the Constitution and gotten so far down the line to where we, the people, couldn't reclaim our counties, but the counties still exist and you still elect your representatives. They've only perverted their positions. So it's easy for us to get this back. That's why counties matter most is really that important, folks. So anyway, you know, it's these are the things that they started actually as they framers, specifically Jefferson and Madison, started realizing these things as they were really testing and chewing on the Constitution. And by 1798, they'd come up with the process of actually holding the federal government accountable, therefore giving us the process of how to hold the states accountable as well as the counties. And this is one of the reasons why everything has been suppressed of what these guys did, and why the judiciary has slowly, what's the best way to do it? They've expunged our knowledge and information about the true processes, and they became the keepers of the process, which literally perverted our entire republic from a republican form of government into a judiciary. So I'm going to stop myself there, and I'm going to climb out, and I'm going to really do my best, because I don't think that there's going to be any other little, you know, points that I will need to kind of dive into and dissect further. The only reason Jefferson was making these comments was just because he had not had the profound understanding and in working within the confines of the Constitution yet. It was literally just somebody else's design, and he was just kind of looking at it and as a bystander. Anyway, So, okay. Now we're ready to go with Sean and dive into the next paragraph. And actually, I believe this is the conclusion of this, but I actually have James Madison back to Thomas Jefferson, popular basis of political authority. This was done, 1790 as a follow-up, right? So when did Jefferson send this? It was December? Was it December? September 889. So a few months later, this is Madison's reply. Go ahead.
Your favor of the 9th of January enclosing one of September last did not get to hand till a few days ago. The idea which the latter revolves is a great one and suggests many interesting reflections to legislators, particularly when contracting and providing for public debts. Whether it can be received in the extent of your reasonings, it is a question which I ought to turn more in my thoughts than I have yet been able to do, before I should be justified in making up a full opinion on it. My first thoughts, though, coinciding with many of yours, lead me to the view the doctrine as not in all respects compatible with the course of human affairs. I will endeavor to sketch the grounds of my skepticism. Okay. As the earth belongs to the living, not to the dead, a living generation can bind itself only. In every society, the will of the majority binds the whole. According to the laws of mortality, a majority of those ripe at any moment for the exercise of their will do not live beyond 19 years. To that term, then, is limited the validity of every act of the society. Nor within that limitation can any declaration of the public will be valid which is not express.
Okay, so right there, what he was doing, what you just read, so people understand, he was citing what Jefferson had wrote. So that right there, that as the earth belongs to the living, that was a quote out of Jefferson's letter. So he basically, that whole paragraph, he was feeding back. And then now he's going to provide some feedback as to his views on what he said in that. And so, Tammy, why don't you go ahead and read, let me see here, these feedbacks to take us down through, you know, the third point. Go ahead.
This I understand to be the outline of the argument. The acts of a political society may be divided into three classes. The fundamental constitution of the government, that's number one. Two, laws involving stipulations which render them irrevocable at the will of the legislature. And three, laws involving no such irrevocable quality.
Okay, so now, see, what he's doing is he's actually looking in his paradigm of this new government. So go ahead now, Sean, and pick up this next, however, applicable in theory from that point. And then,
however applicable in theory the doctrine may be to a constitution, in a constitution, I'm not sure what the sick is for.
Okay, keep going.
Seems liable in practice some very powerful objections. Would not a government so often revised become too mutable to retain those prejudices in its favor which antiquity inspires, and which are perhaps a salutary aid to the most rational government in the most enlightened age? Would not such a periodical revision engender pernicious factions that might not otherwise come into existence? Would not, in fine, a government depending for its existence beyond a fixed date on some positive and authentic intervention of the society itself be too subject to the casualty and consequences of an actual interregnum?
Yeah. Interrogum.
So,
Tammy, go ahead and pick it up from here. Let me see here. Go ahead and read the next three paragraphs, because you're going to start off with, you know, in the second class, okay. And then it goes through that. So go ahead.
In the second class, exceptions at least to the doctrine seem to be requisite both in theory and practice. If the earth be the gift of nature to the living, their title can extend to the earth in its natural state only. The improvements made by the dead form a charge against the living who take the benefit of them. This charge can no otherwise be satisfied than by executing the will of the dead accompanying the improvements. Debts may be incurred for purposes which interest the unborn as well as the living. Such are debts for repelling a conquest, the evils of which descend through many generations. Debts may even be incurred principally for the benefit of posterity. Such, perhaps, is the present debt of the United States, which far exceeds any burdens which the present generation could well apprehend for itself. The term of 19 years might not be sufficient for discharging the debts in either of these cases.
Okay, so obviously he's kind of going through the nitty-gritty details, but he's also pointing, they are limited to the paradigm that they have. Again, I don't believe that the men in these days could fathom the evil that would grab a hold of not only the United States, but the world, and where a large league of evil people would be able to amass the control over the world's resources to a point to be able to literally destroy the people in a context of a world mass calamity. Now, what we're talking about is biblical, right? When I'm saying that, you know, we're talking about a mass calamity, a global calamity of killing people, that's a biblical proportion, right, Sean?
Absolutely.
Okay, so these men were very well aware. These men were very well aware of the scriptures and revelations, because Revelations talks about getting to a point where society gets so amassed, and so, you know, there's so many people that this very affluent group creates this Antichrist, and the formation of true evil starts literally lurking on the earth in its machinations to destroy us. So let's go ahead and now pick up these next few paragraphs. Go ahead, Sean.
In the second class, where are we?
No. So I believe she finished that. So there seems to be a foundation in the nature of things. It's a couple of
Okay.
Okay. And then when you're done with the third one, it kind of indents. We'll have Tammy kind of pick those up on the indents. Go ahead.
There seems then to be a foundation in the nature of things in the relation which one generation bears to another for the descent of obligations from one to another. Equity requires it. Mutual good is promoted by it. All that is indispensable in adjusting the account between the dead and the living is to see that the debits against the latter do not exceed the advances made by the former. Few of the encumbrances entailed on nations would bear liquidation even on this principle. The objections to the doctrine as applied to the third class of acts may perhaps be merely practical, but in that view they appear to be of great force. Unless such laws should be kept in force by new acts regularly anticipating the end of the term, all the rights depending on positive laws, that is, most of the rights of property, would become absolutely defunct. And the most violent struggles be generated between those interested in reviving and those interested in new modeling the former state of property. Nor would events of this kind be improbable. The obstacles to the passage of laws which render a power to repeal inferior to an opportunity of rejecting, as a security against oppression would here render an opportunity of rejecting, an insecure provision against anarchy. Add that the possibility of an event so hazardous to volume 1, page 71, the rights of property could not fail to depreciate its value, that the approach of the crisis would increase this effect.
All right, so from that point, I know it kind of carries on, but from that point, go ahead and pick up right here, Tammy, and read the next couple of paragraphs,
okay,
and we'll go back and forth from that point, okay?
Okay. That the frequent returns of periods superseding all the obligations depending on antecedent laws and usages may be, must by weak Most by weak.
By weakening.
By weakening the reverence of those, yeah. Most by weakening the reverence of those obligations, cooperate with motives to licentiousness, yep, already too powerful, and that the uncertainty incident to such a state of things would on one side discourage the steady exertions of industry produced by permanent laws, and on the other give the disproportionate advantage to the more over the less sagacious and enterprising part of the society.
Right.
I find no relief from these consequences, but in the received doctrine that a tactic assent may be given to establish constitutions and laws, and that this assent may be inferred where no positive dissent appears. It seems less impracticable to remedy by wise plans of government the dangerous operation of this doctrine than to find a remedy for the difficulties inseparable from one from the other.
Okay, so Sean, go ahead and read this next one. It's kind of a long one. And then Tammy can pick up the next one. Go ahead.
I'd like to interject. Sagacious is exhibiting or marked by keen intellectual discernment.
And actually, Madison is doing a very good job of actually identifying that this would actually create an advantage for the debtors or those people that would be able to amass the wealth. Anyway, keep going.
I find no relief from these consequences, but in the received doctrine that a tacit assent may be given to establish constitutions and laws, and that this assent may be inferred where no positive dissent appears. It seems less impractical to remedy by wise plans of the government the dangerous operation of this doctrine than to find a remedy for the difficulties inseparable from the other.
Keep going with this next one, too. Go ahead.
May it not be questioned whether it be possible to exclude wholly the idea of tacit assent without subverting the foundation of civil society? On what principle does the voice of the majority bind the minority? It does not result, I conceive, from the law of nature, but from compact founded on conveniency. A greater proportion might be required by the fundamental constitution of a society, if it were judged eligible. Prior then to the establishment of this principle, unanimity was necessary. In strict theory, at all times, presupposes the assent of every member to the establishment of the rule itself. If this assent cannot be given tacitly or be not implied where no positive evidence forbids, persons born in society would not on attaining ripe age be bound by acts of majority. Neither a unanimous repetition of every law would be necessary on the accession of new members, or an express assent must be obtained from these to the rule by which the voice of the majority is made the voice of the whole.
Okay, so keep any points on this? All right, so go ahead, Tammy, and pick up. If the observations I have hazarded, go ahead from that point.
Yeah, if the observations I have hazarded be not misapplied, it follows that a limitation of the validity of national acts to the computed life of a nation is in some instances not required by theory, and in others cannot be accommodated to practice. The observations are not meant, however, to impeach either the utility of the principle in some particular cases or the general importance of it in the eye of the philosophical legislator. On the contrary, it would give me singular pleasure to see it first announced in the proceedings of the United States and always kept in their view as a salutary curb on the living generation from imposing unjust or unnecessary burdens on their successors.
So let me just jump in right here.
Okay.
The carrying on of debt of government from one generation to the next is literally what he's talking about there, right? The idea that the current generation has created so much debt. Now, here's the key. On this show, we recognize that there is what we call legitimate debt and illegitimate debt. Mm-hmm. Madison would do the exact same thing. What he's referring to here is unjust or unnecessary burdens on their successor, which would be legitimate burdens. When it comes to whether government can actually, whether the people can actually get the government to spend on things they have no authority to do, would not be legitimate burdens. But I just wanted to make clear that he's really pointing this out, that by using government to do some of these things, government could actually be the problem if you actually create it. Because if everybody's familiar with Alexander Teitler's Cycle of Democracy, which came out in the 1700s, the framers were all aware of this principle. It was just Alexander Teitler decided to commit it to paper of how a government, a democratic government, will collapse within every 200 years, just due to the fact that eventually the people will start realizing that, you know, if they can get government to provide for them, that it will increase more and more takers and decrease the makers to a point where government will then finally implode. In other words, there won't be enough makers, and there'll be too many takers, and, you know, the government will literally destroy itself, or the collapse of that democracy. So from that point, go ahead and pick back up where you were. Go ahead.
Okay. But this is a pleasure which I have little hope of enjoying. The spirit of philosophical legislation has never reached some parts of the Union, and is by no means the fashion here, either within or without Congress. The evils suffered and feared from weakness in government and licentiousness in the people have turned the attention more towards the means of strengthening the former than of narrowing its extent in the minds of the latter. Besides this, it is so much easier to espy the little difficulties immediately incident to every great plan than to comprehend its general and remote benefits, that our hemisphere must still be more enlightened before many of the sublime truths which are seen through the medium of philosophy become visible to the naked eye of the ordinary politician.
Okay, so this is Madison's initial feedback on what Jefferson had sent him. The point being that in the current scheme, going down this path would have been very problematic. The problem, and as a matter of fact, the wisdom in having the conversation for the record, to me, helps us see today how there was no way that they could see the pitfalls that were down the road in creating a sanctimonious concept that all property ownership is equal. It is clear that a person that owns property for their subsistence, a person that owns property for them and their direct or immediate needs, is sacred. It is a part of the natural law, or the law of nature and nature's God. But a person to amass property to be able to control and leverage others is tantamount to a person that has elevated themselves above government itself, because we created a government that couldn't do that. And yet government, in protecting and allowing these people to amass these levels of control, become, in whether we like to use the word complicit or not, they become co-partners in controlling, manipulating the minions, you know, those people who are just trying to survive. So the reality is that there was really never a solution that was proffered, because the problem really didn't come, or, you know, I'll just say it didn't develop on their watch. But I'm here to tell you folks that we've had a problem. This problem has been existing for a long time, and we're finally at a point where we see the crap in the river where we can't even get a good clean drink. We can't even get a good clean drink. which means that we have to go upstream and fix this problem. Now, the beautiful thing is that the Constitution, the way it was designed, did not allow the federal government to homogenize all corporations and businesses and regulate them. This is a power assumed by the federal government. And in so doing, they were able to create these and prepare these American businesses to become global businesses. If you look at the global businesses today, almost all of the primary global businesses in the world and their origins are from the United States. Why? Because we actually had a union where the federal government violated the sovereignty of the states where they were supposed to control these corporations. In other words, we had a union that kept the federal government from doing this. In Europe, they didn't even have an economic union, so the problem with corporations and so forth were literally problematic to where government had to start subsidizing, which is why when you look at almost all of the corporations of Europe, they're all subsidized and in league with their state government, whether that be the car manufacturers throughout Europe. It doesn't matter what it is, the farming, so whatever. They've created protectionisms and so forth regarding their own state governments, that they never had the ability to create and allow them to function and operate across the rest of the state boundaries. It was only until the economic union where they were able to start doing some things. So the only place in the world where corporations were literally being able to be put on steroids by being able to increase their productivity, increase their profits, and increase their reach was, lo and behold, the United States. We've got people at the helms and people that have created these corporations, and we all know names. We could all start citing names, but there's so many more. And what's amazing is Elon Musk. Here's a new name that kind of came up, and I don't want to say obscurity because he came up from prominence of himself. Even Bill Gates came up from a prominent family. So it's not like these guys were self-made millionaires. We would be hard-pressed to find that. I think that there are a few. I know Frank Vandersloot is. He's a millionaire out of Idaho.
Bezos.
What's that?
Bezos.
So Bezos was not a self-made millionaire. In other words, he actually went into business creating a deal with the government because the government needed to actually have hands and eyes on everybody, and they wanted Bezos. And Bezos was the one that fed everything that you did in Amazon and so forth, and they started expanding their reach on and on and on. So we're out of time, but Bezos, you know, started, and he operated in the black for years and years where he couldn't even turn a profit. He should have been delisted. The government actually protected him so that he could do the evil that he was doing. So, but you're right. He didn't come from necessarily a deep family like Gates and others. But the fact is, when we actually see, every time we find these governments or these corporations and their associations with government, it all of a sudden really helps us understand how dirty this whole game has been. But anyway, folks, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.